Life. There we go.
Okay.
Good evening, guys. Just let you catch up for a second, as per usual. There we go. We are live for the second time in 2 days. For a special, for a special episode of Live on Drugs with
Oh,
one
sorry,
of ears and hearts.
I'm turning yours off. Sorry, it came through on. I was watching the live stream as well, and the audio suddenly started coming through, so I've turned that off.
Welcome, mate. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming on. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here.
It's my pleasure, Jack. I'm really pleased to be here. I really am.
Fantastic, fantastic. It was really great because I never expect, you put out these things on Twitter, and you were talking about Buddy's song, which is obviously, I feel it's something that connects us, and I made a little plea, and then it all resulted in this, which is fantastic.
Yeah, the beauty of social media,
Yeah,
eh?
I'm
One of the
actually
good
on
things.
Twitter. I love Twitter. Let's get this shared. I did promise I would share it to the Chesney Hawks official fan club on Facebook.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
So let's just get that shared and then we'll get started in a few seconds.
Okay.
Here we go. And then to a group. I usually have people that can do this for me at times, but I'm still learning to get it down to a fine.
You're doing great, man. I love it. You're doing better than I've done for sure.
Had a bit of
A lot.
practice for 3 years,
Yeah,
so
that haven't
again.
done a live stream since COVID, to be honest. That
Where I
was
start.
my big live streaming period.
Same as where I started in October 21 during the second lockdown.
Yeah.
Suffered really badly with depression, and my mate said, interview me. So we started it, as I was saying.
This is your friend, the hostage negotiator.
The hostage and barricade negotiator, Mr. Jason Edwards. He was my first ever
Guest.
guest, but I kind of launched him into his career. He came around to visit me on the request of a friend. He was just, I was suffering from really bad nerves. I was performing on the folk circuit around Norwich, and he came just to speak to me and help me work with my nerves.
Yeah.
And then he kind of hypnotized me, and then decided he was going to become a hypnotherapist, and he got into hostage negotiation, and he qualified in that, and so we're kind of on par for both our careers.
I see, you're kind of symbiotic in a way, that there was a meeting of minds and then it all exploded out into the universe. I love
Yeah. It was
it.
actually, it was boredom on my part, and Jason said, interview me, so I did, and it was great, and
Yeah.
and it's been a fantastic 3 years. I've had some great guests.
Yeah,
Let's go
fantastic.
back. Let's go back to the start of your life, mate, and just find out a little bit about young Chesney.
Okay. Well, what exactly would you like to know? Or do you just want me to just go ahead and talk?
Yeah, well, I know you grew up with a pretty famous father.
Yes. Our household was quite rock and roll. My dad's mates were all 60s superstars, you know. So we grew up in a with guitars propped up in every corner, and my brother and sister and I, all of mum and dad's friends were in entertainment in some one way or another, you know. So the three of us were never going to be accountants. So yeah, it was a very liberal upbringing, I'd say. My dad always says I came out singing, you know. So I never had a proper job or anything like that. The only other job I ever had was paperboy. And we lived in this little town in Berkshire, and I was Billy Ocean's paper boy.
Nice.
He's a good tipper at Christmas time. Yeah.
Nice. Your dad was is Chip Hawks, is that right?
Yes, Chip Hawks, the lead singer and bass player of the Tremolos, and Yeah, I mean, I you know, that was my first kind of taste of music, really, was kind of at a very young age, going to see Dad play gigs. And I have great memories of just kind of sitting behind the wings and watching him with his long flowing hair and knickers being thrown on stage and all that kind of stuff. And even at kind of 7 or 8 years old, I was like, yeah, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. So I take it your family were fully supportive of your want to be a musician.
Yeah, then well, not average kind of parents, I guess, in that respect. Dad, it wasn't like forced onto us or anything. But music was very much part of the blood of all three of us, actually. My brother's drummer, the drummer in my band, amongst other people, and my sister is a singer songwriter and now runs a music school here in Los Angeles. So they were always supportive. But my dad, he's one of those guys that I think he saw from an early age that, if you're passionate about something, follow that, So he was very, very willing to kind of, no matter what I ended up, showing an interest in, I think he would have been happy for me to follow my kind of passions, which is something that I've definitely passed on to my children. It's a if I see something that obviously wets their whistle and floats their boat, as it were. Then I encourage them to kind of follow that. You can tell, can't you? You always know when something is like meant to be, or like it's in the blood or something. My youngest son is a guitar player and well, musician. He plays everything, to be honest, and he's just flying. He's now at the Brit School in London, and he now plays like drums, bass, keyboards, guitar, he's ridiculous. So and it's because he loves music so much, and I could see it from a very, very young age. I was like that, the same.
Yeah, I get that. I was like that with words. I was always good with words, and I liked to sing, and I liked to mess about. But I couldn't get it. I had no way of getting it on paper.
Yeah.
I was the special child. There was no such thing as dyslexia when I was a kid. I was just thick, so
Bless
I
you.
wasn't nurtured, but I was always creative.
Yes, exactly. Well, for me, the creative arts is so important for kids, to help them through that, learning an instrument or painting or any kind of art. It's a way to express your soul, and that's what art is for.
It is. I never had people around me that would encourage that. I had a guy, my best friend, who was like a big brother to me. He used to take me to these poetry slams, these spoken word evenings, where I would perform some of my poetry. But he passed away back in 99. And I kind of gave up on it for a long, long time. It took 20 odd years to write my first book. But yeah, I definitely agree we need people to nurture.
Artistic expression, it's everything, especially for kids, because you just watch them get out, and you can see it in kids, with the way they paint and draw, and or just get kind of like excited about like playing an instrument, or banging on a keyboard or something like that. You can see them wake up, and honestly, I think that it's something that unfortunately, the people in charge of government, politicians, whatever, mainly are not really from that world, that creative world, so they don't really understand it. And so I think, a lot of the initiatives to help kids in schools with music and art is everything's getting cut, and it's really sad to see, because that is the way to wake a child's, mind up. It's imagination is all, it's all integral with creation and the kind of helping a child's mind kind of grow. It's so important, and unfortunately I think that most of the people in charge don't understand it. You know, I mean, we understand it, don't we? Because we are creative people, and we see it. You know, and I see it in my kids, and I know it from myself. But you know, a child with a creative output is always going to be a happy child.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that, especially one that's nurtured. We're quite lucky where we are because the schools nurture creative spirit here. We're about 9 miles outside of Norwich. Yeah. We're absolutely massive in, you know, we've got the garage and we've got the Pauline Quirk Academy.
Yeah.
We've got quite a few people that are sort of nurturing creativity and some.
Yeah, there's some great dance schools around that area as well. I know I've done a couple of things. I love that part of the world, by the way. It's a beautiful part of the world. I love the Broads, and you know, whenever I got gigs that way, I always try and make sure I've got like an afternoon or something to go and, I don't know, just get on a boat in the Broads or something, or just kind of look around the area. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I fell in love with it 20 odd years ago when I moved here. But, you know, as you can tell, I'm not from here. I'm from Wakefield originally.
Yeah, from up Yorkshire way.
Yeah. You know, and Northerners don't really, or didn't back in my day, sort of nurture creativity.
Sure.
But, you know, we're quite lucky here because we get a lot of films made here, which is, you know, the souvenir part two were made here.
Right.
Yeah. So I got my work on those two. And Banged Up Abroad is made here. And, you know, out of Colter Charlotte, former air base and stuff. Jingle Jangle was made here. So we're quite lucky, really.
But, yeah, fantastic. Yeah, wonderful. Film,
you know, I fell in love with, as you can see, I'm a real big...
You're a film buff, aren't you? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that was my sort of escape as a kid. That was my escapism. I had a terrible time at school. I was bullied. I was abused by the teachers, some of the teachers and stuff. And the way that I found my release was watching films VHS. There used to be it was called Sid's Video Shop. It was a little independent video shop in Normanton. And we'd watched Buddy, the series, and then we'd watched Buddy's song in school. Yeah. One of the teachers had rented it. And I used to rent it every week from this video shop. So I just fell in love with it. It was the first film I ever watched that made me think that I wanted to be a filmmaker.
Oh, wow. Well, that's beautiful to hear, because I mean, you know, when you're involved in projects like that, I mean, I was only a youngster, you know, 17 when I got the part in that. And, you know, so as young people are, you're caught up in your own thing, you know, and you don't realize that you might be, you know, involved in something that will affect, you know, a young mind or whatever. That's the kind of stuff that you only realize when, you know, in time, and as time goes by and you meet people like yourself, you know, that it meant something to them. You know, it's like you don't think about that when you're making it. You know, I was just a kid. That's a beautiful thing to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it just, I guess it affected me because it was probably one of the first British films that I ever saw that I kind of identified with. You know, don't get me wrong, I had a loving family, a great loving family, but I was adopted. You know, I mean, I sat and watched Buddy's song this morning, you know, and it gets painful to watch sometimes because you can see sort of, you know, Buddy's from a broken home and his dad's a thief and, you know, his mum off doing other things and trying to be businesswoman. You know, this kid trying to find his own identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he found it through music.
Yeah.
Which is exactly, you know, full circle to what we were just talking about. You know, if that character, Buddy, didn't have music as an outlet for his, you know, for his songwriting was cathartic for him, you know, and he brought it all out. So songs like Torn in Half, or even Man Not a Boy, you know, are just like, they had to be written, they had to come out, so that's the one beautiful thing I love about songwriting. It's a form of therapy, and he found that character Buddy sound found solace in music, even if it was just like listening to music, like from his dad's collection of Buddy Holly records or whatever, obviously influenced a little bit through that kind of genre of music, but had his own thing and wanted to share his own soul through his music. And that's what, keeps you going, keeps you out, off the streets, keeps you off the drugs or whatever it is that you find as a vice, I mean, that's, I know, I can absolutely relate to that myself, so I was so into music when I was young, that I used to just come back from school and just go lock myself in my bedroom and play guitar or listening to music or write songs or whatever it was that I was doing. And I'd lose hours and days doing that, when sometimes some of my friends or whatever were out kind of drinking and doing whatever. I was just, I was obsessed, so I'm a musicaholic.
Yeah, I used to think I identified with Buddy a lot, but after watching it again today for the first time in a couple of years, I kind of identify with Terry a lot.
Right. Yeah.
I've been
Well, you're a
there.
father now, you're a father,
I am a
you
father,
and so you
ex-criminal.
yeah, ex-criminal, whatever, and you've been there, seen it, done it, and probably in your life, early days, you probably did relate to Buddy more because you were more that character. You had hope, you had spirit, you had a creative mind, you wanted to make something of yourself, and those dreams you have as a kid that get chipped away as you get older. But now you're a little older and been through it and experienced all these things, you can relate more to Terry. It's interesting though.
Yeah, I can. Even just in his mannerisms and how he just tried so hard to be a father, but he really struggled with it, because he just, his friend meant a lot to him, and he kept getting nicked for silly things. And I can see that. I can see that in myself. And I
Well,
love
that's
my,
what.
but I loved drugs. So it was just a kind of,
No, of
it's,
course. It's a real character, with beauty and love, but also flaws, and we all have that, and we're all kind of battling our own demons one way or another, aren't we? We all
yeah.
just, as long as you head to the light as much as you possibly can, then you're doing okay,
Yeah, and I'm finally doing okay.
I'm glad to hear it, Jack. Really am.
Tell me about working with Roger Daltrey, the man himself.
Well, I mean, Roger's a very powerful character. I was only 17 when I met Roger, and he was a little bit scary, I'll be honest. But because I'd kind of grown up in a household that, there was a lot of fame around, maybe not to that level. My dad's friends were people like Jerry Marsden, The Searchers, The Marmalade, Herman's Hermits, all those kind of bands, and we even lived in the same town that John Lennon lived when I was a baby, in Sunningdale. So I kind of grew up around fame. So that part of it didn't kind of feel weird, meeting somebody who was very famous. But he's quite powerful. He's very he's strong-willed, which is obviously why he made it, in the first place. He's a scrapper. He grew up in Shepherd's Bush and grew up a fighter, really. I remember I got to know Pete Townsend as well after that, and he was just basically, he would say that, basically Rog was a fighter, and that was one of the things that kind of drew him to him, he realized that, Rog kind of was a go-getter, it's like he was trying to get out of where he came from, and that's how he did it, through music as well, And you know, Rog was very generous with me. You know, I was a young, budding singer-songwriter and a singer, and obviously kind of coming up. And you know, he'd been through all of that, so he had some good advice for me. What, you know, mainly things like, you know, don't ever stop playing live. You know, just keep those kind of pieces of advice that would obviously come from a rocker that had been there and done it and done that. But like, you know, I'll give you an example of what you can be like sometimes. It's like when I did the screen test for Buddy's song. So it was like, it started with like a, you know, big cattle call kind of X Factor style auditions where I joined the back of the line. You know, and then I kept getting through, and you know, I was very lucky to get through to like, it was two boys, and it was a screen test, and we had to do a scene, and it was the scene where Roger slaps me. I say something to him about, oh, you know, or this, the her, I guess the character's parents had split up, and she was off with another man. So I said, "Oh, and she's knocking that man off," or you know, and something like that. And he slaps me, and it was a very emotional scene. And I just had never acted before, and I just presumed that Rod was going to pretend to slap me, and I was going to pretend to be slapped. But I underestimated rock god Daltrey, and he just walloped me around the face. You know, I mean, I had a big old red mark on my face. Honestly, I think it's one of the reasons I got the part, because that was like, they were real tears, you know. And then another part of that same day, I had to play a song on the stage, and it was at Bray Studios, where the Who were rehearsing for one of their big comeback tours or whatever. And Townsend was literally at the back of the room, like just kind of leaning on the wall with his arms crossed like that, watching me play guitar and sing. And I was playing an Elvis song. "Well, that's all right, mama," that one. "That's all right with you." And so I'm playing it, and I'm kind of doing the Elvis moves and stuff, and all of the film people were kind of down, you know, in the crowd watching me. And Roger started to walk towards the stage, and I thought, this is a bit weird. I just kept going, "That's all right, mama." And he walked up the stairs to the side of the stage, walked across the stage, and I'm still singing. And he just walked up to me, grabbed my leg, and he goes, "Stop moving your fucking leg." I was like, "All right, I've blown that one then, you know." What have I done? I thought, "Sorry, sorry, Mr. Daltrey." And I mean, that's what he can be like, you know. He's quite harsh at times, but he's, you know, he's very, very generous with his advice, and you know, he'll stick up for you. You know, you want Roger on your side, and he has been on my side, you know, for 33 years now. So, so you know, I still have a lot of love for him.
That must have been a lot to handle for a 17-year-old, a film that was quite big in its time, and then, you know, wasn't independent by any means, and a music career that went side by side. That must have been a lot for you to take in, you know, the rise to fame that you had.
Yeah, it was quite a lot because I was quite young. I was just 19 when the song, when that record came out, and I'd already started the promotion of the film before that. So I was kind of like doing the rounds with Roger, and I was doing like, you know, Live and Kicking or whatever it was called in those days, you know, the Late Late Show in Ireland, and with Roger, and I'd be, you know, we'd do an interview together, and he'd introduce me, and then I'd play piano and stuff like that, and. Yeah, that was fun. That was fun in those early days. But then, and then when it just kind of took off, that's when, you know, Roger took a back step, and I just kind of went off and did my own thing. And it was like being in the eye of a storm in a way. You know, I didn't really know my ass from my elbow. I didn't know, you know, every day was like a crazy adventure. I mean, great fun times and everything, and I got to travel the world and, you know, headline arenas around the world and stuff like that, and that was phenomenal. But what happens is you lose your life that you had before. It just kind of, I don't know, d goes off into the sunset in a way. Your life is not your own anymore. I don't think I made a kind of life decision, like a normal life decision, in those 2 years. Even as much as what I'm going to pack for to go on tour or whatever it is. Everyone, it's just people just take over, And so I feel like, and when I look back on it now, I put my career and life in the hands of other people that maybe didn't really have my best interests at heart, But I didn't know that at the time. So you live and learn.
I guess that's one sort of downside to being young and being catapulted into the type of fame that you were, that you've got sort of hangers, not just hangers on, but you've got people that are trying to make money from you.
Yeah, I was like merchandise. Yeah, I was the cash cow for a while. And yeah, I mean, you say hangers on, there were hangers on, because there was money. I'd always pick up the bill, and there were sycophants around. And yeah, it's weird. It's a very unnatural state, fame. It's a very weird thing to go through. And is obviously there's only. It's kind of weird, a weird club to be in, to be a member of, and you only really know what it's like, and if you've had a little bit of that, So it's kind of why you end up being friends with other famous people, It's like I was talking to, I was hanging out with Robbie Williams the other day, because I've known Robbie for years, and we were talking about that, to being in the famous club, how people don't really understand what it's like, because the every people that you meet, there's some lovely people out there that can't just want to, come up and say hello, and it's lovely, and I'm a real people person, and I love meeting people, but then you get the odd idiot who'll just come up and just grab you by the neck and just think that you're like, I don't know, part of his property or something, and that. And I guess the underlying kind of subtext to that is, well, you chose to be famous, so what do you think's going to happen? It's like, well, I didn't think that I was going to be manhandled without being, asked or whatever, But it's a very odd thing. It's like people. The other thing that happens is that people think they know you, like really know you. And they just. It can be kind of space invadey a little bit, and as I said before, I'm a very nice kind of good guy. And I like meeting people, and most people are really, really lovely, and there's a lot of love out there, and I guess that's a lot to do with time. Time is a great healer on in that respect. In those 30 years since I first became famous. My fame has kind of changed. It's weird to witness it. Like, when it first happened, I was just kind of like the new boy there, and of course you're kind of open to the haters, and open to being knocked down by the press and all that kind of stuff. And then after kind of 10, 15 years after that, and you're still around, and you then become kind of like. It's like a cult thing happens, about the music or whatever, about the fame, and so it becomes about a time, and then after a while, you almost it's so weird the way it happens. People have this kind of almost like you're a national treasure or something. I mean, I definitely don't think about that myself in that in those words. It's just it's weird how being a part of the national zeitgeist for decades. It changes the way people think about your fame, if you see what I mean. It's really weird. I can't even explain it.
I get it. I get it a lot, because unlike I suppose a lot of famous people, they're in and out of press, and they have their bits where they're favourite and when not. Whereas you, I guess you've stayed away from sort of sensationalism in part, and that sort of, you know, headline making. You've led a relatively quiet life.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. I'm still known for my music, so you know, sometimes people are known for hell raising or being shagger of the week or whatever it is. I'm still known for that period. I mean, it's weird because I'm kind of defined by, you know, a 6 month period when I was 19 years old, and a lot of people define me by that, you know, which is also a little bit odd, because obviously I'm a human being, and you know, we all have a rich tapestry that we weave through our life, and you know, I'm obviously more than that record. But it happens, you know. And I'm not at all, I know it probably sounds like I'm a bit bitter about it, I'm not at all, I'm really not. I understand why people you know, have those thoughts about me, and you know, it's just nice to be able to talk about other sides to me, and you know, other parts of my life, you know. Some people, like, you know, I meet people sometimes when they'll say, like, what do you mean you've got kids? I'm like, yeah, I'm a 51-year-old man. That's kind of what happens, you know. They're like, but I still see you as that young floppy-haired boy. I'm like, yeah, I was that. It's like, you know, it's kind of crazy how people just only remember you for that one thing, and there's no way I could have had a life after that, you know.
I do get that. I do get it. But I, you know, I did, I occasionally get recognised for doing the souvenir, which is great. You know, it's nice. And I've got fans on Twitter.
Of course you have, yeah.
That's weird. Weird for me, having fans on Twitter and Facebook. And then I've got, you know, people that recognise me from my books. You know, I'm open to a lot of trolling because of the subject matter of the books that I write. I don't write nice, fluffy books. I write books about injustice, like escaping human trafficking, and my latest one is about escaping domestic violence and highlighting those stories and giving a voice to those people. But I get trolls. I suppose you've had your odd Twitter troll. It's not exactly the nicest.
No, it's a modern day problem. I think you know, social media it's easy to troll people, and obviously it's not just famous people. You know, it's like, you know, kids get this issue quite a lot, and it can be really, really harmful, and to an extent where, you know, some kids will take their life, and it, you know, it's a real issue, and I'm glad that. I'm glad that schools have taken a hard line on cyberbullying, and that, you know, I had a little experience of that myself with my son. He was cyberbullied, you know, at a young age, and it was really tough, really, really tough, because there's a slight, you know, these kids are anonymous, you know, really. It's just you know, it's easy to make a social media handle and just kind of without any real name behind it, you know, so you can be as mean as you possibly want without any repercussions, you know. So yeah, I feel like it is an issue. I mean, you know, you are open to it if you're famous for obvious reasons, but it is a problem all over, you know, especially for children, vulnerable kids that are susceptible to just kind of believing these things, you know. And I feel like it's an issue that needs to be, you know, very much in the forefront in media, because it can cause all sorts of problems, you know, in a child's life, you know, now when they're kids, and also, you know, later on when they have to kind of deal with the kind of mental scars that they have left over from it in later life.
It's hurtful. It is. It's really hurtful and unjustified. But I think if you're like me, you have to learn to sort of push that off. It used to really hurt at the start when it, you know. I guess it's I mean, I know you live in LA, and it must be such a culture difference to go, for our kids growing up in LA and growing up in Britain. It must be such a different sort of mind-blowing experience, really.
Yeah, it's very different, that is for sure. I mean, the great thing with my kids is they grew up early days in the UK and had that kind of British way about them, you know. They kind of like have great sense of humor, and they don't mind kind of taking the piss a little bit here and there, and you know, a little bit of banter, and which they got from me and my lovely wife, and obviously all their family and everything else. So when they came here, they were a little different, you know. They were, and that caused a little bit of an issue at times, but you know that. I honestly, I think that with ki if kids have a loving, stable, you know, nurturing relationship with their family, they then they they've then half the battle is won. You know, I'm sure you probably will appreciate that and agree with me on that one.
Yeah, I think we have to take a different approach in raising our kids than certainly how I was raised. I was raised by a hairy ass Yorkshireman, a railwayman, ex-miner. So I know the sort of that sort of discipline, but it's just. The world today is a scary place. I'm not a soft fella. I used to fight people for a living. I'm not a soft fella, but it scares me out there because we've got high knife crime, lots of murders, and it's so scary out. It's so different. It's not how it should be.
I agree. I worry about my boy. He only just turned 17. He's living in London, you know, and he's running around the trains and just kind of living his life. And you know, as you said, it's a dangerous place out there. And you know, he's told me about a couple of almost fights that he's got into. Some kid, like, you know, picking on a girl, and of course he's, you know, a chivalrous boy because he's lovely, and he's like, leave her alone, you know. And of course he starts pushing him around, and you just never know, do you? You just never know moments like that. Guys, yeah, it's scary. It's scary out there, and you know, these kids have been through a lot, this generation. You know, you can't underestimate the gravity of COVID, for them either. You know, like, you know, my eldest, he's 21 now, but like, he missed out on all of the kind of things that kids of his age go have, you know, gone th go through without even thinking about it, like your prom and like your graduation and all that kind of stuff. And that, he didn't get any of it, and they got none of it, you know. And then there's the younger generation that kind of, you know, had that kind of year and a half, almost 2 years without being at school, without being with other kids and learning to integrate and socially kind of be together, you know. And now they're having to figure that out, you know. It's a strange old world we're living in at the moment.
It is, and like I said, my eldest is 17 in May. And we've got another one that's 16 in May. Ranging from 17 down to 9. And the attitudes are just so different. Especially around games like Fortnite, which is the bane of my life.
Oh, I
But
know, mate, I know. Well, any kind of computer game stuff, because that's how they meet their friends. It's a very different world to what we grew up in. I mean, you're younger than me, but like, you know, it's like I met my friends at school, or I met them at the pub, or you know, out and about, face to face, as it were. All of my kids' friends are all people they've met playing games. You know, it's like, and he's, you know, I say to my son, who are you with? And he's like, oh, that's my friend Morgan or whatever. I'm like, well, who's Morgan? I'm like, oh, we play, you know, computer games. He lives in Idaho. Like, okay. It's just different, isn't it? It's just a different world.
It is. We have to be so vigilant here, because not everybody's what the same, and I'm really aware of that. in the
Of
job that
course.
I do.
Of course. Yeah, I do worry about that. I do. You know, it's like my daughter is 19. She's studying in Scotland, and you know, she's doing kind of dating stuff online, and you know, sometimes some of the people that I hear about, I'm like, are you sure they're what they say they are and who they say they are? You know, it's like you just don't know. Yeah.
No,
Scary.
I've had a couple of bad experiences online. Even myself,
Yeah.
I outed a or helped out a guy. There was a child trafficker that
Yeah.
was on my Facebook, and he was trying to get into the British film industry.
What
And
the hell?
he got a job on quite a sort of major independent film here, set film,
Yeah,
and.
film set.
He got kicked off because people found out that he was this child trafficker. And the amount of paedophiles that I've had to that been outed just
Yeah.
through Facebook and through this 6 degrees of separation, it's
No, it's
just
crazy. It's
scary.
everywhere. It's everywhere. I work with you know, child sex trafficking charity called A21. I don't, you probably know them. And
No, one, yeah.
yeah, so I've been working with them for a while now. And, you know, I went to B Bulgaria on a mission with them, and you know, just the stories and the statistics are just mind-blowing. You know, and when you say it's everywhere, it really is everywhere. You know, it's like it's in your town. This is happening. It's not just, you know, people being trafficked from, you know, Eastern Europe or whatever, you know, all the places that you hear about. It's happening everywhere. And it's really, really scary.
Is people think it's like Liam Neeson and
Yeah, exactly.
their kids go over to I don't know Bulgaria or somewhere or
Yeah.
Thailand and they get kidnapped. It's most trafficking is domestic trafficking
Yeah.
through our country.
Yeah.
40.3 million people worldwide
Yeah.
are still being trafficked to this day.
Yeah.
I'm lucky. I've worked with a lot of them. I've taken a lot of their stories. But I wrote Between the Streetlights and Red Lights because I wanted to find people that were brave enough to share their stories when I wasn't brave enough to share my own.
Yeah.
And
Wow.
it's through them sharing their stories I then started sharing mine.
Yeah.
And it's mind-blowing. So some of the things that happen, and it's families,
Yeah.
it's friends, it's uncles, it's fathers, and it's like, whoa, I didn't realize that that was such a problem.
Yeah, people don't know, do they? And that's why, you know, it's so important to educate and talk about it on podcasts like this. In fact, I'm so glad and so grateful to you for, you know, being able to talk about this stuff. You know, it's like I do a lot of podcasts, you know, and don't really often get to talk about the stuff that really matters like this. So, and, you know, I appreciate you and your work, that what you do. It's pretty amazing. You know, you should be proud of what you do, mate.
I appreciate that. Thank you. It's taken a long time to get here, and like I say, it's not always appreciated by other people. I've been threatened by traffickers. I've been threatened by people online.
Yeah.
I've got a family.
Of course, yeah.
I met my wife when I was homeless and addicted. I went to a food bank, and she was serving there.
Oh God, that's an amazing story, Jack.
She served me a cup of tea, a cup of coffee even, and she liked my Doctor Who t-shirt. We got talking and she showed me so much kindness. Took me out for a meal, bought me sandwiches, bought me tobacco, helped me buy electric for a place that I was staying at on and off.
Yeah.
And we got married in 2019.
That's a beautiful story, man. I love that.
She's often said she saw the person now.
Right,
Saw
she
who
saw
I
through it all and see what you were.
am now.
Yeah.
What I could be when,
Yeah.
even other people within that sort of church setting
Are you crazy?
had to
Yeah,
get away
yeah.
from him. You don't want to
Yeah,
be in a
exactly. He's a drug addict, he's homeless. What are you doing? Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's all right to feed him, but
Yes, but don't bring him in, for God's sake.
Exactly. Well, it's nice to be able to. So I mean, the church that I'm involved in, we've got a food bank at our church, and we're building a shop that will be able to sell at a vastly reduced rate of supermarkets. We live in an area, it's a really nice town, but unfortunately, due to austerity and the Conservative government, don't have a lot of money. People don't have a lot of money around here, so poverty, we're on the poverty line. And it's not good. I don't know what it was like in LA during the pandemic, but here all the banks are now closing. We're losing another bank. We've lost about six or seven shops in this past 2 years due to COVID, and it's so hard.
It was sad to see that happen, and that did happen. I think that happened world over, obviously LA is a little bit of a bubble, but we live right in the center of LA, and I'm on Ventura Boulevard, which is kind of like, I don't know, the Oxford Street of LA, I guess, in a way. And just walking along there, there's all sorts of, it's more of a kind of like boutique places and that kind of thing, small family run places, like little shops and little restaurants and things like that. And walking up and down there during COVID, everything boarded up, and not a lot of them came back because, what can you do? You can't carry on just hemorrhaging money. So a lot of these little businesses all just they just went, It's really sad.
It is. I suppose LA is quite a high threshold of homelessness.
Very much so. Los Angeles has become really, really like a real problem over here. It really has. And of course, it's one of those weird things where, there's an elite here in Hollywood, that just kind of want to, I don't know, clean them out, as it were. They're talking those kind of terms, But COVID actually obviously made it a lot worse because a lot of people weren't able to afford housing and ended up on the street. And but there is we have a good governor over here, Governor Newsom, and he has really tackled the problem. And he's there's all sorts of new housing for homeless people, and there's loads and loads of food banks. It's almost on every corner. Like if you go in downtown and everything, you see it all over the place. And these people are really, there are places to turn now. It's getting much better. But I think at one point it was like a serious issue where people were. I mean, every single bridge, it was like a town, a little homeless town, and yeah, it's I think it's getting a little bit better these days, but yeah, it's definitely an issue.
It is. I do know a few people over there that are part of the Bethel Church in Reading, and I do know that they do a lot on the streets, bringing food and stuff like that. I don't really know about America, what I've actually seen on sort of online and TV, and I think it's kind of a sort of a boxed view, because we don't know what's going on. You don't see, you only see what people want you to see. And
No, I mean, listen, it's the same the world over in a way that I think that communities will come together and help their fellow man. It's that happens everywhere. And you only have to look for that, and if you want to give back and you want to be part of a community that gives back to local issues, and I think you can always find that, and America is no different in that way. And there are people over here that, like, my wife's from the Midwest, absolute salt of the earth. I would say that's kind of like equivalent to a Yorkshire or something like that, you know what I mean? It's like, people really, really help each other out, and lovely people.
yeah, it's sort of like farms and families. I mean, that's nice to see, but you see it here, but you don't really see it in the cities, which is kind of sad. There is just here, there's still that north and south divide as well.
Course.
So I am aware that you need to be leaving soon, but what's next for Mr. Hawks?
What's next for me? I've got my own podcast, you know, darling. In fact, that's what I'm doing in a minute. I'm recording another episode of my podcast, Ferguson Harrington Hawks, which starts a new series this week, I think. And so I'm doing that. I've got a new album, which I say new. I had this ready just as COVID hit, so it's kind of been pushed back and back. And if my fan club are listening or watching this, they're going to be like, "It's not new. We just don't have it yet." So I'm definitely getting a little bit of that from some of my fans. So that album, I promise, will be out this year. You heard it here first. And I've got some touring to do, so I'm gigging a lot. There's all sort. Anyone's interested, ChesneyHawks.com. That's got everything Chesney related there. So you know, come and see me on, come and find me on the road, and I'll come find you, Jack. If I'm in Norfolk, we'll go and have a cup of coffee or something.
Yeah, we've got our town is brilliant for coffee houses. It's one every sort of few hundred yards. It's absolutely great.
Perfect.
Absolutely love it.
I love it. Yeah. Well, if it, as long as it's got more coffee houses than pubs, we'll be all right.
Well, we've got a lot of pubs as well,
Of
but
course.
I stay away from them.
Stay
You
away
know,
from those, yeah, love you.
the coffee houses are great, and they're very supportive of me. You know,
Yeah.
it's lovely to have a town that sort of nurtures my creativity as well, you know.
Yeah.
And
Absolutely.
they
And
do.
I listen, if there's any, ever anything I can do, and if you'd like you know, my help in any way, just let me know, mate.
I
Because as I
really
said,
appreciate
I
that, and that
well
absolutely means the world to me. You know, I'm welling up at that. That is just absolutely beautiful, and thank you for that.
I mean it, because I you know, I really appreciate and grateful to you for the work that you do. And I think we're, you know, we think in the same way. So, you know, I'm here for you.
I will send a copy of the books via your team. I will
Thank you,
grab
mate.
this and I'll.
I'd love to see him. I really would. And I promise we'll definitely grab a coffee in Norfolk next time I'm there. You come see the gig, maybe.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that. It's been an absolute delight. I'm going to end this broadcast now. And
Thanks for
guys,
having me, mate.
thank you ever so much for tuning in, as always.
Yeah, thanks to everyone that was listening there.